On 88.1, I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Maryland Morning. Before the Supreme Court's historic decision last summer that said states could no longer ban same-sex marriage, there was Edie Windsor and her real estate taxes. Roberta Kaplan is the lawyer who took Edie Windsor's case to the Supreme Court, and when she won, the Defense of Marriage Act was no more. In advance of her talk in Baltimore this week, Roberta Kaplan takes us behind the scenes of that seminal case. And the poet Daniel Mark Epstein presents a survey of his work that spans nearly 50 years. He'll introduce us to his latest book, Dawn to Twilight. Plus, the holidays are upon us with the joys and stress that they entail. This morning, the connection between stress and fat with Dr. Pam Peek from the University of Maryland Medical School. The environment in focus with Tom Pelton as well. First, the news.
I'm producer Kathleen Cahill. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, and 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Morning, everybody. On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. In the fall of 1996, Congress passed by an overwhelming margin the Defense of Marriage Act, which defined marriage in the eyes of the federal government as being between a man and a woman. DOMA, as it's known, was declared unconstitutional by the Supreme Court in 2013, the same year that Maryland's Civil Marriage Protection Act became law after voters here became the first in the nation to approve same-sex marriage by referendum. My first guest this morning is Roberta Kaplan, the lawyer who argued the landmark Supreme Court case that overturned DOMA. She wrote a book about that experience, and she'll be speaking about it tomorrow night at an event sponsored by the Public Justice Center. The book is called Then Comes Marriage, United States v. Windsor and the Defeat of DOMA. Roberta Kaplan joins me on the line this morning from New York. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me here.
Thanks for being here, and thanks for this really fascinating book. Just give us a little primer for folks who may not recall. DOMA was introduced by Congressman Bob Barr in Georgia in May of 1996. What did that law state?
It's kind of incredible when you look back on it. DOMA was very unusual law in a lot of ways. But I think one of the ways it was most unusual was the fact that when it was passed in 1996, it had absolutely no impact on anyone. And what I mean by that is what DOMA said, or what the section of DOMA that we challenged said, is that if gay people ever get a chance to get married in any state, anywhere in the country, then that marriage, for purposes of federal law, is not a marriage. It's null and void. But the incredible thing is, back in 1996, no gay people were getting married anywhere in the country. That did not happen until 2003 in Massachusetts. So it was purely a hypothetical law when it was being passed.
President Clinton signed it into law literally in the middle of the night, so no one would putatively notice. And in this book, you interpolate your own story of your own coming out, your marriage to your wife, Rachel, your son, Jacob. And you tell a touching story about when Jacob was born, the hospital personnel would not let you carry him out of the hospital because you weren't a legal parent.
Yeah, so our son was born actually shortly before I argued the New York marriage case, which was the New York court's highest court, the Court of Appeals, that I lost. And just before that, our son was born, and we had a terrible experience where he had jaundice when he was born, and so he was under the lights in the NIC, what they call the NICU, for at least 3-4 days. And when it was finally time to take him home, and we were all ready, and my wife had a C-section, so she was still pretty sore, the hospital personnel wouldn't let me do so. They made my wife get up from bed and go get him because they said that I wasn't recognizable as a legal parent.
So the impact of this law was, in one of your arguments at the Supreme Court, was that there were impacts of this law that Congress did not anticipate. We'll talk a little bit about that, but first tell us a bit about Edie Windsor and her wife, Thea Speier.
So, you know, I was so lucky to be asked by Edie to represent her in this case, and I think we as a gay community and, frankly, this country are so lucky that she ended up being the plaintiff who won this case and carried this message. The life that she lived, both before she ever met Thea and then for the 44 years that she was together with Thea, is such a testament, I think, not only to bravery and courage, but to what so many gay people had to live through for so many years in ways that I think that young people today don't even understand. So just the highlights I'll give you. Edie grew up in Philadelphia. She's not very far from you guys. Her father lost his business, and they lost their family home during the Depression. She went to Temple University, and while she was at Temple, she actually fell in love with another woman. But the idea back then of living her life as a queer, which is her word, was inconceivable. This was the 50s, and no one was living their lives openly as gay unless you were really willing to live on the margins of society. So she got married to a guy. That's how she gets the name Windsor. The marriage, needless to say, did not last very long. After a matter of months, she told her husband that he deserved to be loved the way he really deserved to be loved and that she needed something else. And like so many other people, myself, a couple decades later, she moved to New York, or three decades later, she moved to New York in order to be gay, as she put it. And then after kind of struggling in New York and becoming one of the earliest computer programmers in the country, she was at dinner one night in the Village, and a woman by the name of Thea Speier was brought over to her table. At least from Edie's perspective, it was love at first sight. According to Edie, not so for Thea. She kind of chased Thea for a couple years. But then after a couple years, they got together. And the truly amazing part of the story is what happened for the next 40 years, because Thea was diagnosed with a particularly terrible form of multiple sclerosis about 10 years into their relationship. Over time, she lost use of her legs, her arms. By the time she died, she was paralyzed. Edie has said that that diagnosis happened to both of them and that they both made sure that as little in their lives changed as possible. And we know that that's true because on the day Thea died, she actually had two patients. She was a psychologist, and she had two patients who she was supposed to see that day. Look, the one thing that I know about in life is that no one knows what life holds for you, right? We don't know. No one knows, God forbid, that you could wake up one morning and find out that day from your doctor that you have MS. But the one thing that I think we all do know is if, God forbid, that happens to any of us, we would all want to have a spouse like Edie Windsor at our side.
Roberta Kaplan, the book is called Then Comes Marriage, United States v. Windsor and the Defeat of DOMA. She'll be speaking in Baltimore tomorrow night on 88.1. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Ms. Windsor's case centered around the fact that she was stuck with a huge real estate bill. And you write in the book that had her name been Edie Windsor, she wouldn't have had to pay that. But because she was a woman and not legally her marriage was not legally recognized. They did, we should say, she and Thea got married in Canada in 2007. But the federal government didn't recognize that marriage. So this was a real estate case as you started winding its way through the courts until you got to the Supreme Court.
Yeah, it was like a lot of great American issues. It started out as a tax issue. You know, our country started out as a tax fight, too. So this was a fight about taxes. Edie, basically, when she inherited their estate, inherited Thea's estate, and she inherited the apartment that they had lived in and bought together, she had to pay a huge tax on Thea's half because, as you can imagine, the value of New York City real estate increased over the 30 years that they'd held it. The tax bill was $363,000. It was essentially a tax on being gay. And Edie decided that she felt indignant at having to pay that tax, and she decided to sue.
So you go through the lower courts, and you win in the Second Circuit Court on an argument premised on the notion of heightened scrutiny. What does that mean?
So it's complicated. It's kind of a legal term, a lawyer's term, and I hate to kind of get into legal terminology with people, but what it essentially means is that there are certain kinds of laws that if the legislature passes a law that treats certain groups of people differently than other groups of people, black people, women, et cetera, then the courts, when they look at those laws, when they're challenged, they need to look at them pretty carefully because we assume in our society that the legislature should not be in the business of passing laws that treat black people differently or women differently or now gay people differently. So that's what heightened scrutiny is all about, and I'm very, very proud to say that we won that in the Second Circuit. And the Second Circuit said that laws that treat gay people differently are subject to that kind of heightened scrutiny.
And for a while, there's a question as to whether or not the Supreme Court would take up your case. They eventually did. The Obama administration and Eric Holder, the attorney general, decided not to defend the law. So your opposition in this case was a group formed by Congress. The acronym is BLAG, the Bipartisan Legal Advisory Group, who argued the case in support of the law on behalf of Congress. You win the case, and you do so by using a phrase, or one of the things you use as you argue it, is the notion that times can blind. So in 2013, when you win, were you able to convince the court that things were just a whole lot different than they were in 1996?
Yeah, I mean, there was no question that they were. I don't think that was the harder part of my argument. I think they all accepted the fact that there's been this sea change, as Justice Scalia called it, a sea change in how Americans understand gay people. And gay people have always been around. It's not like Americans didn't know gay people going back to 1996. What's changed is that Americans now know that they know gay people, right?
Right.
Because so many gay people have come out of the closet. And that really is the sense I use, this language, times can blind, that comes out of Justice Kennedy's decision in Lawrence in 2003, in which he held that you can't criminalize being gay. And I really do think it says what this is all about, that sometimes in our country, times can blind us to moral truths that we don't realize. And in the past, Americans didn't realize that gay people and gay couples and people like Edie and Thea had the same dignity as everyone else.
So you argued that case in 2013. At that time, there were 13 states that allowed same-sex marriage. And after the case, that number shot up to 37. And then 2 years later, in April of 2015, there was a case called Obergefell versus Hodges, in which the Supreme Court ruled that nobody, no state could ban same-sex marriage. Moving forward, of course, a lot of people, when that historic decision came down last summer, they said, well, it's still the case in a lot of places that you can be married in the morning and then go back to work and lose your job. What is the next step for the gay rights community when it comes to the law and when it comes to knocking down the remaining barriers to being treated equally?
Let me be clear. The one thing that is clear, I think, from Windsor and Obergefell is that the government can't discriminate against people because they're gay. So if you have a government job, local, state, or federal, you can't be fired anymore in this country because you're gay. But that leaves open, as you suggested, the big question, which is what about private employers? What about private businesses? And that's very much kind of a mixed map right now. There are many states like New York, that prohibit discrimination against people because they're gay. There are many other states that need to pass those laws, and there are efforts underway. We could solve the whole problem if the federal government, Congress, passed that law, and there's legislation pending in Congress. But Congress, as we all know, is not exactly energetic about passing new laws today. So one other approach that's been taken is the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission actually takes the position today that if you're fired from a job because you're gay, that's sex discrimination because you're being fired based on gender stereotypes. And if that's what happened, that's already illegal because it violates Title VII of federal law.
Roberta Kaplan, the book is called Then Comes Marriage, United States v. Windsor and the Defeat of DOMA. The Public Justice Center here in Baltimore has named Ms. Kaplan the Francis D. Murnahan Jr. Appellate Advocacy Fellow. She'll talk about her book and reflect on her successful argument at the Supreme Court tomorrow night at 6:30 at the Walters Art Museum. The event is free, but they'd like you to RSVP. We've got a link to do that on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Roberta Kaplan, thanks so much for your time and enjoy your trip to Baltimore. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Is there an issue that you'd like to see us cover? Let us know. You can email us at mdmorning@wypr.org, or you can leave us a voicemail. Just call 410-881-3162. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. That's all at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, on with the show.
Daniel Mark Epstein has written numerous plays and acclaimed biographies of an eclectic group of historical figures that includes Amy Semple McPherson, Nat King Cole, Bob Dylan, and Abraham Lincoln. He has also garnered prizes for his 8 books of poetry, and this morning he joins me in the studio to talk about his latest collection of new and selected poems, which includes work that spans nearly 50 years. It's called Dawn to Twilight. Dan, it's really good to see you again.
Always a pleasure, Tom.
And congratulations on this collection, which, as I mentioned, you know, starts in the 60s and goes right up to the present time. It's a terrific, terrific collection. Is this an opportunity to sort of look back on this amazing body of work of yours?
It's an extraordinary opportunity for me to see what I've written over the last 50 years, what my poetry has included, as well as the things that it hasn't included. So it's been a very good kind of self-critical exercise for me. I'm very happy with the poems that I have written. I think that during each period of my life, from my 20s until my 60s, really, I've been able to write about the things that mattered most to me, being in love, getting married, fatherhood, trying to be a good son, trying to understand about education, educating students, learning from my children, learning from my parents. That's another big theme in the book.
Sure.
I'm very happy about that dimension of the poetry.
Do you see a progression in your style? Do you see a progression in your craft? Do they get better as you get older?
I think so. I've learned more about metrics. I've learned more about sound. I think that my effects are probably more subtle. The rhymes are not so harsh when there is rhyme. I think that my imagery is more pointed and careful than it was when I was younger. And of course, the main thing is that I know more.
Yeah.
I know more about life. I've felt more things, and I have more of a sense of what needs to be said and what can be left out.
Well, I wanted to ask you to read several poems. I wonder if we could start with Old Man by the River. And talking about knowing more, this is an earlier poem, and the poems are arranged basically chronologically. So this is an early one, but it's about old age. And so it's interesting to me to get your young man's take on an old man's life.
Well, thank you. That's one of the dimensions that I like to capture in my poetry. Old Man by the River. Flood tide, boats glide high above the bank, daylilies crane to look into the sun. What kind of friends would leave me here alone, an empty house behind me, a full graveyard ranging from my door to the garrulous river? Kind friends and true to leave me with my thoughts. My teeth are gone, my hair's a white cyclone. I have more secrets than heaven will ever know. Take my daffodils. What a bargain of light for the reckless April that discovers them. Little girls with lightning quick hands arrest the leaping blossoms in mid-flight and lay them on my doorstep in the night. Today I scared the boy who brings the news. I'm a weathered man, the adventure of whose conversation nature has immured. Three walls are deadpan stone, the last is the river. Who will I talk to when the river runs away?
Daniel Mark Epstein reading Old Man by the River from his latest collection of poems, Dawn to Twilight.
And I was about, 23 years old when I wrote that poem.
Right. So what
about
do we know,
the old man?
Well, what do we know about old age when we're 23? Well, you know, it seems like you actually knew a fair amount. And, I mean, do you think your take on senior citizenhood holds up pretty well now that you're getting close to being a senior citizen yourself?
Well, there's a certain innocence about these two old men. There are a couple of old man poems here. About when they're dying, they're going to take the whole world with them. They're going to take the sun and the moon, and their children will have to find their way in the dark. That's really not the way I see things now. It's these are poems that about pretending to be an old man that I could only have written as a young man.
Right, exactly. There's another I'd like you to read. It's called Helen. This even has a traditional rhyme scheme. This is a poem.
It's a little dialogue between a teacher who's teaching a music class, and his students are they're wanting a love story. They're tired of the regular music lesson they've been getting. Helen, tell us a love story, pleaded the class in chorus. Our lessons are all done. Now don't lecture or bore us, they prattled, except for one. Helen, whose gaze looked lost in the maze of willow branches, the girl the boys liked most for the faraway blue of her eyes and brown hair straight as rain. Tell us a love story, please, they begged the teacher again. He frowned and longed for the bell, saying, all the love stories I know end in heartache or death. Then Helen, from the back row, called at last from her daydream in the voice of an innocent lover. tell us a love story anyway, and stop before it is over.
Oh, I love that. Stop before it is over. There are a couple of other great love poems in here. There's one that I'm intending to steal very soon and send it to my wife anonymously. It's called The Date. As you said, love and love's lost and love's gained are you know, themes throughout the book, as they are themes throughout anybody's life. But I love this one.
Well, thank you. The Date. Just as you were about to step out in your sleek black sequin dress, fresh from the secondhand store, veteran chic, as only a 50-year-old dress knows how to be. Just as you pulled the shades down by the ring and shut the door, as you were walking toward night and the rest of your life, a lover, a quiet place where you might find one. Just as you stopped for the passing car that braked so the boys could whistle as you kicked back your leg, looked over your shoulder to check if the stocking seam had run askew. Just as you passed outside the bar, I saw you as you saw yourself in the turtle shell compact, making sure it was the same you as left home. Just then, you thought of my words, felt warm inside, and now you must stay with me forever.
You must stay with me forever.
It's in a tradition of poems that attempt to capture the reader in the magic of the words. Now you must stay with me forever because my words are in your head.
Yeah, yeah. Every writer's dream, I guess, right? I mean, what's the perfect reader for a poem that you've written?
Well, I think it's somebody who's coming to the poem with an open mind and an open heart. Poetry is the communication of a passion. The good reader of poems, I think, is a collaborator. You know, he or she brings to the poem their own experiences. If you're a woman reading this poem, hopefully you'll imagine yourself in the role of that woman. Or if you're a man reading the poem, you'll imagine you're the poet.
Daniel Mark Epstein is talking about his new book, Dawn to Twilight, New and Selected Poems. On 88.1, I'm Tom Hall. You've written a bunch of biographies. That's one of the other things that you do. Last time you were on the show, we talked about this terrific book you wrote about Bob Dylan. There's a couple of biographical and several autobiographical poems here in this collection. One of the ones that I thought was really fascinating is called Magic for Houdini.
As I was mentioning earlier, I'm fascinated by virtuosity, and Houdini, of course, was one of the greatest magicians of all time. And here he's attending a performance by lesser musicians magicians and trying to be gracious, which he is. Magic for Houdini. After the feast in his honor, the magician checked his watch, blinked, palmed a yawn, as amateurs turned water into wine or wine into water, and beamed at his applause. Next, one held a cigarette paper rolled betwixt thumb and forefinger and beguiled the crowd with faultless patter, promising to turn this sheer paper into a live moth. Gracefully, he rolled the paper. Smiling, he made a fist. But then the truth upstaged the actor, as it sometimes does. When he opened up his hand again, the smile that had been poised above success died on his lips. Where life should have been, a flutter of fresh wings as the moth flew free, death left its ashes, the poor bug's remains. Knowing the greatest delusion ends in folly, as even the best magicians fail sometimes to make the incredible act a certainty, Houdini raised his hands to start a round of clapping to mask the man's embarrassment, a simple trick of professional courtesy, for the thing boldly attempted, bravely lost, and maybe a little sympathy for the moth. But then the audience drew in its breath. A living moth came flying from nowhere and circled the mortified magician's hair once, twice, three times. Crackling applause that might have come from pity came from fear, and no one's dread ran deeper than the master's, who was all too familiar with these powers of darkness. He would be dead within a year.
In the notes to the book, you say that this book is there's an absence of longer and dramatic poems. You've purposely chosen shorter poems that you say emerge as a unified autobiography. So in Houdini, you prove again your great adroitness at writing biography, because you've written a bunch of actual biographies. But I wonder, what do we learn autobiographically about you as a person and as a poet and as a writer reading these poems in this collection?
This particular book really does follow the arc of my life from my early 20s to my 60s as a poet learning his craft, as a young man falling in love, not just once but several times, and eventually getting married. There are poems about my marriage. There are poems about being a young father. There are poems about my relationship with my own parents as I was learning from my children. I was also learning how to take care of my parents, who eventually would need my support. So it follows that part of my life as a family man. And it also follows my life as a witness to history. In the 20th and the 21st century, there's a poem. There are poems about Iraq. There's a poem about 9/11, and autobiographically saying, what was it like to be a poet and an observer and a citizen in America?
At those
exact moments, and I'm very proud, you know, that I was able to that my muse engaged those larger themes as well as the private themes of my own life.
I wonder if you could read the title poem for us. This is dedicated to your mother, and it's inspired by a Victor Hugo poem.
Dawn to Twilight. Tomorrow morning, while the dew is fresh, brightening the green fields, I will set out in my car for the eastern shore, where I know you are waiting for me. I will leave Baltimore and cross the Severn, the blue tidewater cut with white sails. I will drive over the Bay Bridge as mist unveils the ships and barges far below. In no hurry. I know you will be waiting, though I do not want to be away from you a minute longer. When I get to the village, I will take the left fork that goes north along the lane of red cedar trees, then park the car and walk. Hearing nothing, seeing nothing, my hands clasped behind me, holding each other. I will not notice the first stars of twilight or hear the last songbirds of the day. Night and day will seem all the same to me. When at last I reach my destination, I shall place upon your grave one sunflower from the field across the way.
That's so beautiful. And then, of course, when you find out that it's dedicated to your mom and you realize that the person is not going out on a date, but rather going someplace else, it's just really stunning. Really appreciate your coming by and sharing some.
Well, thank you for having me here.
Daniel Mark Epstein, his new collection of poems is called Dawn to Twilight. Dan will be reading from his collection tonight at the Ivy Bookshop in North Baltimore. That event starts at 7 o'clock. And for folks in Chestertown, Dan will be reading at the Book Plate on Friday night at 6 o'clock. We've got a link to more information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Maryland Morning. Coming up after a break for the news, Dr. Pam Peek will check in with her about the correlation between stress and fat.
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. Again, that's at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
I'm happy to welcome back to the program Dr. Pam Peek. She is a clinical assistant professor of medicine at the University of Maryland School of Medicine and the author of several books, including her latest, The Hunger Fix. One of her best-selling books is called Fight Fat After 40, where she talks about the relationship between fat and stress. So with Thanksgiving coming up next week, complete with the stress that often accompanies the holidays, we thought that today would be a great time to check in with Dr. Peek. She joins us on the phone from Bethesda. Hey, Pam, how you doing?
Hey, I'm doing perfectly fine, and there's a reason why stress spelled backwards is dessert.
Stress spelled backwards is desserts? There you go.
That's right. Yeah. I'm just saying, it's not kale, it's not arugula, it's dessert.
It's desserts, exactly. Well, you know, stress is one of those things, I think everybody thinks they know what stress is, but they may not. How do you actually define stress?
You know, stress is inherent to life. I mean, you need to have stress to be able to stay awake and be alert. And as a stress physiologist, it's really, you know, you live by the movement of stress throughout the day from the moment you wake up. You thought it was your alarm that woke you up. Forget that noise. What actually woke you up was a spike in stress hormone with its best friend, adrenaline. And that goes on all day long, keeps you on your tippy toes when you have to give a presentation. So stress in and of itself is absolutely wonderful to have in your life. It's a beautiful balancing thing, keeps you learning. But the stress I'm talking about, when you start going over the line and stress becomes something associated with feelings of helplessness, hopelessness, and defeat, right? Mm-hmm. When that happens, then all of a sudden we start into action, an entire cascade of problems in your body.
Yeah, because there are physiological consequences to those emotional feelings. Yeah.
Well, fight and flight. It's fight and flight on acid. It just keeps going and going and going. Fight and flight itself is supposed to be quite short term. Okay, see dinosaur, run like heck. Get to your cave, we're cool. It's all over. You know, have a nice day, Mr. You know, Tyrannosaurus. Okay. But when we do this 21st century stuff that just keeps going and going and going, let's talk about Thanksgiving, for instance, right? We've got the holidays coming up. So all of a sudden, we're sitting there stressed out. We've got who coming to dinner? Oh, gosh, who invited him or her? That was a mistake. Too late. So you now have stress. And you also have the stress of perfectionism. I want a perfect dinner. I want everything to go absolutely perfectly. It goes on and on.
And sometimes you end up cooking for, you know, 6 hours, and then people wolf it down in 20 minutes, and then there's Aunt Mildred staring at Uncle Harry. Yeah. It could be tough.
And then, well, that could get ugly right there.
Yeah.
But all by itself. So really, you know what it is? It's a balancing act. You could neutralize a lot of this stress easily by simply infusing your life with ways to be able to de-stress. You don't have to, you know, join an ashram somewhere. It's very simple. It's called take a flip and walk. Assume the vertical, open the door, you know, slip on the gloves if you need them, and get rocking. Or as I say, walk your dog, even if you don't have one. Just get on out there. And I'm not kidding you. What it does, if it controls everything from appetite to mood, you change gene expression in your cells, all for the positive. You end up being much more in control. You may not solve the world's problems. If you do, you know, God bless, but 9 out of 10 you won't. But you will feel like you can cope and manage much better.
Yeah, because
that's where it is.
Yeah, you talk about how certain kinds of stress, long-term stress, and what you refer to as toxic stress, and you come right out and say in this book, you say it can make you fat and keep you fat. So what is the relationship between having this so-called toxic stress and weight gain?
One of the things we found, when I wrote Fight Fat After 40, which is really considered to be the Bible of what happens to your body fat distribution, especially after the age of 40. It can happen any time in your life, but especially after the age of 40 when your sex hormones are beginning to fluctuate and make it a lot easier to pack on the weight. But where does the weight go? It goes around the belly and deep inside the belly. Why do we care? Because the fat deep inside the belly if you have an adequate amount, a normal amount, is life-saving. It's very good. However, you can have too much of a good thing. And when you have toxic stress, stoking a stress hormone-induced appetite, hint, it's never arugula that you reach for when you're stressed out. What you want is not a tuna on a bed of greens. It's always the hyperpalatables, sugary, fatty, salty food combos that you find to be comforting. We found in science they actually reduce stress hormone levels in the short term, and then they come rebounding back three times, you know, worse. So what you actually end up doing is you stimulate fat deposition deep inside the belly, underneath the abdominal muscle wall. And when you get too much of that stuff, that kind of little bit of a bowling ball looking, you know, tummy, or even a pumpkin looking tummy, that's bad news because it's highly associated with diabetes, heart disease, and cancer. That's why you always want to make sure you're understanding the toxic stress fat connection, because that fat goes deep inside your belly.
You also write not only about what to eat, but when to eat it. You talk about chronobiology because you want to navigate what you call the cortisone hours, which I guess are a particular time of day when you're most vulnerable to stress eating.
Exactly. Well, you know, it's interesting. What we found was that if you really go to primal rhythms, circadian rhythms in our body, what we've been able to find is chrono, or, you know, time-related and circadian rhythm-related biologists have found that most people are most energetic when they first get up in the morning, whatever that time may be. It's all relative to each person. And that's because, as I mentioned before, stress hormone and adrenaline should be highest then. And then as you course through the day, you notice right around 3 o'clock, it's like, oh gosh, you know, I need a nap, or I need a little coffee, or I need a little pick-me-up, or whatever the issue is. That's because all of a sudden the cortisol and the adrenaline are starting to decline. And then you're finding that around 5 to 6 o'clock, okay, we're really feeling poopy now. And normally you'd kind of get ready to, you know, have an early dinner and go to bed. You know, but needless to say, that doesn't happen in 21st century, you know, world, because we have lights and screens and things to keep you up until heaven knows when. So we're really fighting against our own rhythms here. So I'm asking people to stick to the rhythms, you know, the primal rhythms as closely as possible, because that will be the best way to be able to get the, you know, an optimal way to stick with the highest level of metabolism and the least likelihood of going off and derailing yourself with eating at strange times and packing on the pounds.
Dr. Pam Peake, she wrote a best-selling book called Fight Fat After 40, The Stress-Fat Connection. Her latest book is called The Hunger Fix. She's a clinical assistant professor of medicine at the University of Maryland Medical School. Happy Thanksgiving, Pam. Appreciate it. And we'll talk to you soon.
Same to you.
That's it for us today here on Maryland Morning on 88.1. For Nathan Sterner, I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for joining us. Have a great day.